Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome to today's U College Talk. Going to be talking about all things college basketball, college football, a lot of things going on with National Signing Day today. Going to kick things off, though, with college basketball to get first couple callers on. Hey, Bobby.
Hey,
how's it going?
How are you?
Great.
Doing
pretty well.
Now next to Virginia's man.
I know. I was going to say, I know you're ecstatic now that the Cavaliers lost. But I know somebody who is not all that happy for that. And that would be Bev. Bev, how are you?
Not as good as Bobby,
I'm guessing. Yeah. Yeah, I would have guessed.
I'm currently in the middle of the woods right now on a run. It's beautiful, guys. It's beautiful.
I just don't, you know, start breathing heavily throughout, you know, the podcast here. But first order of business before we get to the Virginia and Kentucky bickering. Just about half an hour ago, the story just got posted on Today's U. Syracuse self-imposed a postseason ban. That means Jim Boeheim and the Orange will not go to the NCAA tournament. They probably would have been a bubble team. They won't play in the ACC tournament. Bobby, do you think this would have been a Syracuse Orange team that would have made the tournament? I know it's going to be tough to motivate them now, but do you think they would have made the tournament eventually, or was it going to be an NIT team to begin with?
It was actually probably going to be an NCAA tournament team. Their schedule got significantly easier this month, so they probably would have started playing their way in. However, this is probably Tony Bennett's doing just to get Virginia an easier ACC schedule since they still have to play. They're probably an NCAA. I mean, the way their schedule eased up, it still would have been quality wins, but easier for them. That they would have been an NCAA tournament team. To me, it's bigger for the ACC tournament. We've seen weird things happen before the ACC became what it is now in that conference tournament, going back to when Maryland won it as, I believe, like an 8th seed or 4th seed, one of the two, a couple years back. So that's where it's actually going to be weird where to not see Syracuse in the conference tournament, because anything could happen in the span of 4 days.
Hello? Did I lose y'all, or am I still with y'all?
No, we're still here.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I was making sure it sounded like I went out for a second. I'm with Bobby. I was going to say earlier, but I didn't want to cut anybody off. They did, in fact, pick a good year to self-impose this ban because I don't really think they're going to do anything. But, it's interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing really what it's all about. I heard about it when I wasn't even near a computer, so this is kind of the first I've really heard about it.
Yeah, I heard it on my way home today or tonight. I saw it And like I said, though, I think with the way the schedule just kind of eased up for them, they had a chance to kind of get to the benchmark wins that they needed to. That, you know, with the way college basketball is this year, you got to fill out 65 teams or 68 teams. It's going to be hard to fill that out. You know, it would have been easier to make this year with it being, you know, kind of a down year record-wise in college basketball. I think we may have lost Colin.
Colin. I definitely, in fact, think we lost him.
Yep. Oh.
So I guess we're going to start this thing over. Or how are we going to handle this?
I have no idea.
Word. Okay. But, yeah, man, I, I was thinking about you during that UVA game. I was like, damn it, Duke is about to win this, and I'm going to take hell for it. But
well, you almost got it. If they didn't come back to Carolina,
then that first half against Carolina, they were looking like it was going to be two in a row. And then
yeah,
Carolina turned into give the ball to Marcus Paige, and that just became way too easy to defend.
I think like 15 minutes into like the second half, they'd only held them to like 15 points or something. And
yeah, it was 15 points up. The last 15:37 or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something ridiculous. Carolina was up one at the half, and then everything just fell apart. I actually didn't see all of it. I was actually at a concert in Charlottesville, and I kind of left, like, between every song, like when the guy I was seeing was taking a break to talk, I got a free ticket, so I went. But I caught most of the second half, and, they stepped it up. I don't know if I was their lucky charm, but I definitely wasn't against Duke when Duke finished freaking 6 of 8 from three to finish the game.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch much of the Duke game because I was watching Kentucky. But I was flipping back and forth during commercials and flipped over for the last couple minutes. And
yeah,
when they were trading 3 for 2, I was sitting there going, Duke's going to win this.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because, Duke started like 0 of 9 from outside. And then, I think in like the final like 5 or 6 minutes, they were like 6 of 8 to close it out. And Tyus Jones and Quinn Cook just went off. And, Virginia was dumb and still decided to double down on Okafor, even though Okafor hadn't done anything all day. So, I don't know.
Yeah, but do you really want if you're Virginia, do you really want to go one-on-one with Toby against Okafor?
No, probably not. But, in a way, no. But at the same time, I mean, when you're up, 9 to 11 points, I would rather have – hey, call back in, guys. Okay, gotcha. We're calling.
Gotcha. All right. You guys there?
Yes, we are. We've been talking.
All right. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened here. Is this Bev?
Yes.
All right. And then, hey, Bobby.
Is Bobby here?
I don't know what happened
there,
but we lost it all for a second, but we're back. Bev, we'll go back to you. Do you think Syracuse is a team with a guy like Jim Boeheim, one of the coaching greats? Can he motivate them to still have a pretty good season, one that would justify being in the NCAA tournament if they were eligible, or is this going to be a case where they sort of lose interest and spiral downward?
I don't know. I mean, because it's hard because I don't really think they're that good of a team anyway, and I don't really think they had a whole lot to play for. I mean, I agree with Bobby. Like, I do think they would have into the NCAA tournament, but, I mean, I didn't think they were going to do anything once they got there or anything. And I don't know. I mean, obviously it'd be good for them to have a good year just in terms of, when it comes down to recruiting and stuff like that, it's always good. But I don't know. I mean, there's no real point to the season, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think it is. It's only for right now, at least. I mean, we'll find out more. They do have a hearing with the NCAA coming up pretty soon here. They also had one back in October. So for right now, it's just one season. Then again, this is something that just broke recently. We could find out more. But you hate for guys like Rakeem Christmas, who's a senior, who's one of those unsung heroes, not just on Syracuse's team, but really in the whole conference in the nation. I mean, averages a double-double. So you hate for a guy like to what Bobby actually wants to talk about, and that's Kentucky being the last. They got a little bit of a from Jordan playing double digits. Bobby, do you think is the toughest remaining game for them the one at Georgia, since Georgia sort of gave them some problems at home there for a little bit? Or are there any other tougher games besides the one at Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, it is probably at Georgia. I've been saying the entire year it's at LSU just because of LSU having the ability to have two NBA caliber big guys, which other teams in the SEC don't really have that luxury. So, I mean, those are obviously the toughest. If Florida would beat Vanderbilt, this weekend's game would have been interesting with it being the game day at Florida. Most likely no Trey Lyles for Kentucky. But the way Florida's looked, even without Trey Lyles, it should be a fairly easy win for Kentucky.
Yeah, it's tough to figure out what happened to Florida. I mean, it's one thing when you have a number 7 preseason ranking and you sort of fall out of the top 10, go in and out of the top 25, but they just fell off the map. And
well,
you wouldn't
they're really,
that
really
from.
Bad. It's directly correlated to Chris Walker and Casey Hill. I mean, two McDonald's All-American prize recruits. And they – Chris Walker flat out sucks. Like, he is not good
at
basketball.
He's not good at basketball.
So, I mean, that goes – I mean, there's your talent right there. I mean, you have those two with Frazier and Finney Smith. If they would have turned into something, I still think Hill can turn into – a decent college basketball player. But, I mean, these are two guys that were supposed to be the cornerstones of the team. And when they don't pan out, you know, now there goes the Florida team. So,
you see it every year.
That's directly correlated to. Right.
So, Bev, do you think that, you know, there's the argument that Kentucky would do well for them themselves to lose a game before the NCAA tournament, whether that's the regular season or the SEC tournament? If you're thinking they're bound to lose one at some point, you just hope that's not in the tournament. If you were a Kentucky fan like Bobby, would you think that it might be best for the team to lose a game before the tournament, or is it just, you know, whatever happens, you know, if they have a chance to go undefeated, let's, you know, make it happen regular season and SEC tournament too?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I never think it's good to lose. I mean, I know that a lot of people say, like, it's healthy to lose a game. And it's like, I understand that if a team has been playing like crap and have really, you know, eked out really, really close wins. But, I mean, you know, Kentucky's been beating teams pretty handily. And I don't really put a whole lot of stock into a good loss thing. I mean, if you're talking about a team that's maybe like 1 or 2 years away from being a legit team, you know, and they lose a bunch of games by like 2 points to top 10 teams, I mean, that's one thing. But I mean, when you're talking about a team that good, I don't think it's good to lose, and I don't really think they're gonna lose. So, I mean, maybe at LSU, I see them maybe going down at LSU, but I'm giving LSU like a 7% chance in that game. Like,
and that's the highest percent chance of anybody beating them. I mean, that's not a joke. I mean, it could very well be the case. But I know your Cavs went down this week, Bev. But they did also pick up an impressive win as well. So do you think that they, kind of like we're saying for Kentucky, might be better off with a loss, especially if they're going through sort of the gauntlet in the ACC right now? Virginia actually wasn't tested as much as Kentucky ahead of their loss, where Kentucky had some overtime games. Do you think the loss helps Virginia, not just, you know, long-term, but in the ACC race trying to win that second ACC crown in a row?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, again, I don't think it's ever good to lose. That's always – I mean, that's never good. But, I mean, maybe, you know, like in the way they lost, I think – Like, I think in the way they lost, you could consider it a wake-up call because, because they had played even though they were up 11 in the second half, they never really played that well throughout the whole game. They benefited a lot from Duke being cold from the floor because they started like 0-9 from 3, and then like the last 6 minutes they went 6-8 from 3 because it's Duke, and they always do that, and I hate them. But, the one positive about that game, but I mean, the biggest positive to me is that it was kind of a demoralizing loss, but at the same time, it's like, you know, they played like crap for the majority of the game, and they lost because of two deep threes by like Tyus Jones.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
And Quinn Cook hit one. So, I mean, like, I don't think it was a terrible loss, but it's still a loss. Like, I don't think they really benefited from losing. Unless, you know, you consider the fact that they had some close calls before. You know, they came out against Carolina, were sluggish in the first half, and then kind of just killed them in the second half. So that was good.
I think isn't why Virginia lost that game. And that's what sealed the win for Duke. The two deep threes isn't why Virginia lost that game. It's what sealed the game for Duke. It's the fact that Virginia is going to struggle against teams with a strong physical wing like Justice Winslow, who can shut down Justin Anderson, and a post player that's a threat. Because you're not going to go one-on-one. I understand the pack line defense, but you're not going to – if you have, like, Jahlil Okafor, like we said earlier, do you really trust Mike Toby guarding him one-on-one?
No. I mean,
Virginia can't play against those type of teams.
Yeah, but Okafor didn't exactly have what anybody would consider a good game. Winslow wasn't anything exceptional. I mean, I don't really think that's
Winslow
why they
lost.
Winslow
was the best player on the floor that game. Justice Winslow? I guess double in like the first half wasn't good.
Yeah, well, I'm talking more about the second half. He didn't do much down the stretch, but
he was in foul trouble most of the second half when he picked up that ridiculous intentional foul.
I think you're really calling that a ridiculous intentional foul? Is that a joke? He wrapped him up and brought him down to the ground.
That's what I'm saying.
How is that a ridiculous call?
I'm saying it was a ridiculous call by Winslow.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, Sorry. I thought you were saying it was just like a normal play. Sorry.
Is that Duke pretty much in 10 minutes showed why they could either win the national championship or losing the first round, which is not that uncommon for, you know, Duke teams in the last decade. So, again, if they get hot from outside and Jahlil Okafor isn't too much of a liability defensively on the inside, they can beat anybody. We'll go away from the Kentucky-Virginia storyline for a while. Tonight, big game in terms of the bubble. We can finally start talking about that bubble watch. March is clearly less than a month away. Texas and Oklahoma State are playing tonight. Texas has to be one of the most confusing teams in the nation. They're at the top 10 early in the season, and then they get Isaiah Taylor back, and all of a sudden they have this identity crisis. Bobby, who do you think wins this game tonight, but also who do you think is better positioned long-term to try and be on the right side of the bubble in March between Texas and Oklahoma State?
Oh, gosh. Is there a real winner tonight? Because the world has to watch it.
The scoreboard says there has to be a winner.
Coach. Right. I keep wanting to believe in Texas. They are just way too talented. But Rick Barnes is still the head coach there, and Rick Barnes is a terrible college basketball coach.
Yes,
he just can't win. I mean, this is a prime example of Rick Barnes doing what Rick Barnes does, of having exceptional talent and failing. I mean, it's been – I understand maybe the first game or two when Taylor coming back, struggling, saying, okay, You know, we got our star guard back. Javon Felix played well, but Taylor's a different type of player. What do we want to do? Miles Turner coming on. But it's been a month, a little more than a month and a half now of this just, like you said, they're the most confusing team in the country. But
yeah.
So my gut keeps saying Texas because I see the talent they have. I see the depth, the height that they have. And, they have to win at some point. At some point, I almost just expect the players to pull the Varsity Blues and just not listen to Rick Barnes. So, I'm just saying Texas just because I've been on them all year, and I still think they're just way too talented.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Bev, if you were Rick Barnes, or actually, let's just say instead of that, if you were the head coach of Texas, would you think about putting Isaiah Taylor on the bench and bringing him off the bench and just seeing if they can get back to that sort of bruising, down low identity? Would you try and change up something like that with a player of Taylor's caliber, or do you just sort of wait it out and hope that, you know, something changes in the next month?
You know, I mean, that's hard to say. I mean, like, I definitely think there would be a better player with – I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, because he is such a good player. And I guess, is he a really good player? Have we determined that he's a really good player?
Isaiah Taylor?
Yeah,
he's really good.
I figured, but just for like a hot sports take. Sorry. I also just got in my car, so I kind of got sidetracked for a second. Sorry. It's kind of hard. Like, I kind of look at it the same way as I looked at – but at the same time, it's different because Duke brought Kyrie Irving back into the NCAA tournament after he hadn't really played the entire year. And, I mean, like, I think they should just play Isaiah Taylor and go to a pound-it-down-low style of play. I mean, they would win games that way. Their strength is inside. And Rick Barnes would just say, that's what we need to do. You know, Isaiah, you may not get yours, but for the betterment of the team, throw the damn ball into the post. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It hurts me because I like Rick Barnes as a person. I really do. But every single year he gives me another reason to doubt his coaching ability. And by doubting his coaching ability, I mean make me think he's a terrible coach. But
yeah, I mean, we can definitely establish that Isaiah Taylor is a really good player. I don't know if we can say that, you know, you can insert him back into the lineup like Kyrie Irving and just have everything be all fine and dandy.
Everything wasn't all fine and dandy with Kyrie Irving. That's kind of what I was saying.
That's true. Speaking of some of these point guards, though, one thing I wanted to talk about was this year especially, you have a lot of quality, clearly freshmen, but also freshman point guards. D'Angelo Russell, I know, Bobby, you're really high on him. We talked about Tyus Jones. I mean, he's been clutch throughout the year, really. From the first game on, he's hit some daggers. Bobby, do you think that the best freshman or the best point guard in the nation is a freshman this year, or would you go with one of the more veteran players?
It completely depends what you define as a point guard. I mean, if you consider D'Angelo Russell a point guard, then it's tough to say no about him. But
yeah,
it's all depends. For me, I'm very, very high on Monte Morris out at Iowa State. To me, he's the definition of a point guard. Yeah, he doesn't turn the ball over. I mean, he set a career high in turnovers against Kansas with like three. he can score. He's a decent enough shooting threat, and he distributes. So to me, it's Tyus Jones is kind of that next tier I don't think he's in that top tier. The top tier for me, D'Angelo Russell, DeLon Wright, and Monte Morris are the three who I think are the three best point guards. You can really interchange them based on your system and what you want your point guard to do. They're each a little bit different, but those are the top three in my mind.
Yeah, it's tough to argue with those, and especially if we're talking 40-minute game, you know, Tyus Jones still has some developing to do, but I've just been really impressed with, you know, when you need a shot, he normally has one. Bev, would you go the ACC freshman point guard route, or are you thinking outside of that as well with Bobby?
Yeah, you know, I mean, going along with what Bobby said, I mean, if we're calling D'Angelo Russell a point guard, he is hands down. He's probably my favorite player in college basketball this year. He's just incredible. And that's a lot for me to say because I hate Ohio State. But, I mean, definitely D'Angelo Russell. I mean, that dude is just on another level. And when it comes down to, like, pure point guards, I'm going to say Kevin Pangos because I love Kevin Pangos. And I just want an excuse to bring up Kevin Pangos into a conversation. I think he's good at leading a team. I think Gonzaga is actually really, really good.
Hey, they're number two in the nation. You can bring them up whenever.
That's true. It would have been nice had they beaten Arizona, but, you know, it's okay. They're still number two.
But then Bobby would have another, you know, undefeated team to rank well below everyone else. So
I love Gonzaga. Look at my rankings all year. I've had Gonzaga higher than most.
That's true. All right, well, we're gonna end it pretty soon here. We'll just do a couple quick takes to close things out before we get into college football and National Signing Day. I want your one non-top 10 team that could win the national championship this year and basically be the Connecticut of this season. If you're looking outside the top 10, outside the top two or three seeds, I realize we're in early February, but what's a team right now, Bobby, that you think could make a run in the dance?
Two things. I know we mentioned Ohio State lost in the Syracuse news. Mark Loving's been suspended indefinitely. So that's a huge blow for Ohio State going forward. So in terms of who can be, you know, the next Connecticut, if Loving was still there, it would be hard to say no about the comparisons to D'Angelo Russell pulling a Shabazz or Kemba. But I'm sticking with them. They're still outside the top 10 right now. For me, it's Iowa State. They don't play a lick of defense, but Jameel McCase is a strong enough rim protector. If they get hot and all it takes is six games, they can score with anybody in the country.
Yeah. Tough to argue with that. Bev, you thinking along the same lines? Or are you going with, UNC or Notre Dame with the scoring guards that they have? What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, that's all right. I actually don't really see any teams outside of the top 10 winning. I mean, I would say Notre Dame. Good games they've played this year. I've been really impressed. Even though they like Iowa State. Don't play defense really well at all. I do think they can outscore opponents. Carolina has the talent. I mean, Carolina always has the talent, but I mean, Carolina's really talented. I just don't think. I don't want to say – I'm not going to say it because it would have sounded really, really mean. But I just don't trust them. I think they just lose games down the stretch. I just don't think they're a smart team, and I don't trust them. I think they're inconsistent. And I think especially when Nate Britt starts taking jump shots, there's just no hope for that team. because it's Nate Britt, and watching him take jump shots is just fun.
Although he made
a couple
good
games,
in the
though.
Game against Virginia. Yeah. But
yeah,
I would agree.
He's had a couple good games.
If Jerian Grant scores 25 a game in the Big Dance, Notre Dame could very well, you know, run to a title. And it's not like 25 points for Jerian Grant is that far-fetched. So, I mean, we'll keep an eye on that. He could have a special March. But thank you guys.
And I like Iowa State, too.
You know,
I like Iowa State.
All right,
so,
both of you on the Iowa State bandwagon. Thank you guys for helping out with today's U podcast. You can read a bunch of Bobby's work on Today's U and follow him on Twitter at UKLefty22. You can also read Bev's stuff, especially on the recruiting side. We're getting a lot of great pieces for basketball and football recruiting. And Bev needs a Twitter, so we'll get on that pretty soon here. Thank you, guys.
# Bev needs a Twitter. If enough people do it, I will definitely get a Twitter. I'm probably getting one anyway, but make the # happen. Much
love. All right, thanks, guys.
All right, see you, man.
All right, we're going to get going on some college football talk. Lots of updates on the National Signing Day front. Hey, Dustin, how's it going? Sorry, is this Ryan here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Ryan. Let me get Dustin on the line as well.
All right.
Hey, Dustin, sorry I got your numbers mixed up there. You doing all right?
Hey, I'm good, Colin. How are you?
Doing pretty well. So it's been a very busy day in the college football world, despite it being February, because, of course, it is National Signing Day. There's always a little bit of drama on this day, or a lot of it, but especially because you have guys who are still in high school trying to make a pretty big decision. Sort of the running story today was early this morning, Auburn got a commit from the number one recruit in the nation, Cowart, and then he was sort of waffling back and forth between Auburn and Florida. And it turns out that Florida did, in fact, get his faxed letter of intent. He is going there. But, Ryan, do you see this as an issue in terms of players not fully committing to teams? You know, you wonder if they're going to transfer. Is that an issue when a guy like that heads into the locker room for the first time in the fall? Or is this just one of those tough-to-make-a-decision, let's-get-on-with-it sort of things?
Well, you know, it's actually not even the first time that we've seen basically this exact same scenario before. A couple of years ago, Cyrus Kwanjo originally committed on an ESPN ceremony and said that he was going to go to Auburn before ultimately flipping and eventually signing his letter of intent and attending the University of Alabama. And we saw, you know, his career went rather swimmingly while he was there. He was a part of a national championship team. So this isn't something that, you know, we're entirely not used to at this point. Obviously, if you could take a little bit of the uncertainty out of it, it'd be nice. But anytime we're talking about 17-year-old kids and decisions of this magnitude, there's just going to be some indecisiveness there. And what we saw with Byron Cowart today was, you know, Auburn was a decision that he made late in the process because, you know, the guy that he was most comfortable with was Will Muschamp, who was at Florida previously, and if Will Muschamp had stayed at Florida, he probably would have signed with the Gators. What ultimately happened was Muschamp obviously goes to Auburn to become the defensive coordinator, and they've kind of very quickly rekindled the relationship there, and his relationship with a coach kind of won out versus his comfortability with the school, and I think that's what created some of the issue there. But, you know, Cowart is officially signed for Auburn now, and that's a done deal, so.
Yeah, I think it's just part of the job, I guess, for some of these coordinators and clearly head coaches. Got to be on the edge of your seat pretty much all of National Signing Day, hoping guys don't flip or anything like that. Dustin, do you think that with this class, because Auburn really had a great day on the recruiting front, not just with Cowart, do you think that Will Muschamp can make a big difference in this first season and really kind of get that off Auburn defense matching what the offense has done for a few years now and really be one of the best in the country, or is it going to take a process kind of like we talk about head coaches taking 2 or 3 years sometimes to really put their stamp on the program?
Well, I think the transition's a little bit easier for a guy who's been a head coach and seems to know his defensive strategy pretty well. I think it's a little bit easier to implement his style on one side of the ball. I don't know. I would expect Auburn to be pretty good defensively this season. I don't know compare against teams like Alabama and LSU defensively, just because they are going through a bit of a transition period there. On the whole, I don't know how I feel about Auburn replacing so much talent on the offensive end, because you're talking about losing Nick Marshall and Sammy Coates and Chris Payne, and that's a pretty big trio to replace. I think they're going to have their hands full. Whether or not Will Muschamp can come in and make a difference defensively to get this team winning football games, it seems that when that's the scenario, the transition is a little bit easier. I know it wasn't a perfect season, but Lane Kiffin's pretty put that down at Alabama. He was able to get, a guy in Blake Sims who, at the beginning of the season, nobody really trusted, and got him to be playing some pretty consistent football there down the when it was most important. So I think it'd be interesting to see how Muschamp handles it. I expect the defense to be good at Auburn, but like I said, how it's going to match up against teams like Alabama, LSU, and some of those traditional big or strong good SEC defenses, I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, I think in very soon here, and a down year for Auburn probably doesn't look that bad. I think no matter how much adjusting it takes, when you have Gus Malzahn and Will Muschamp, they're going to be right back in the thick of things pretty soon, if not, the next year. Another SEC team that made a big splash today, they don't necessarily have the deepest recruiting class, but they got the number 2 recruit in the nation. That's Mizzou, and it's Terry Beckner Jr. committed to them, that cornerback. Ryan, do you think that, because Mizzou now has won 2 out of the last 3 SEC East titles, and they still are kind of this, I don't want to say underdog, but nobody really predicted them this year to win the SEC East, just like the last time they won it. Do you think now that they're sort of signing these big-time recruits along with Alabama, Auburn, and the likes, do you think now that both on the field and in the recruiting front, they're finally going to start getting some more respect?
Well, I think Gary Pinkel has kind of prided himself on his ability to take and develop relatively unheralded recruiting classes throughout the course of his career at Missouri, both in the Big 12 and now in the SEC. He's had a lot of players who have produced well above what their star rating, if you will, kind of dictated that they will. So the idea of him starting with this kind of talent certainly is pretty scary. I mean, we've seen what Missouri's done with guys like Shane Ray, who was a 3-star recruit, and Michael Sam, who was a 3-star recruit. So the idea of them getting a 4- or 5-star defensive tackle in there like Terry Beckner Jr. is definitely a little bit disconcerting if you're in the SEC East. That's not a person that you want to have to face on a down-after-down basis. He's just a dominant bull of a man in there at 3 technique, and he's not going to be fun for guards to handle on a weekly basis. If he continues to pull recruits like this, and we've seen occasionally that Missouri can do this. They can go out and get the number 1 player in the country, like a Doriel Green Beckham a few years ago. They can go out and get the number 2 player in the country, according to ESPN, like a Terry Beckner Jr. Sheldon Richardson, who's with the Jets now. I mean, they occasionally can go out there and get players like this, but overall, as long as they continue to coach these guys up, whether their recruiting class is ranked 50 or if it's rated 30th, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with in the SEC East.
Yeah, I think, every year they sort of surprise. It shouldn't be a surprise anymore, but I think because of those recruiting classes being in the 30 to 50 range, people don't expect it. But Dustin, do you think this coming season that Mizzou is going to be right up there again in the SEC East? Do they have a chance to repeat? I know you have a team like Georgia that returns Nick Chubb. You have Tennessee, which was so young last year but is so talented and has Joshua Dobbs playing really well the second half of the season. Do you think Mizzou can repeat, or is it going to be one of these teams that might on paper seem more talented that finally sort of fulfills that potential?
Well, that's a good question, because
you know, as you mentioned, this is a team that traditionally is one that we count out or disregard as one of the top teams in the country. And they always seem to me, Colin, like they're almost like the new Clemson of the SEC. And I hate to use Clemson as a verb, but I'm going to have to. just because they always seem to lose one of those games that they should win. And this year it was against Indiana. Indiana was not a good team. They had a good player, but they weren't a good team. And so how they lost that game was interesting. And so, you know, they always seem to be fairly consistent all around. You know, they had one of the best defenses a season ago, only giving up about 3 touchdowns a game. Their passing game wasn't really that good, so that'll have to be improved. But, you know, as Ryan mentioned, this is a team that really proves itself year in, year out. And, you know, I think Tennessee might be the quiet favorite in that division. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Missouri at the top because Pinkel continually wins with Missouri.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. What I would point out there was that he's had one losing season since 2005, and that was his first year in the SEC. So he's consistently getting to the postseason. He's got Missouri in the conversation and in the top 25 pretty consistently. So I wouldn't be surprised if Missouri's again back at the top of the SEC East.
Yeah, I can definitely see that happening again. And as we saw in this bowl season, you know, you don't want to overreact too much, but the SEC East was the better division in the bowl season, at least. Now you have to look at the matchups they had. But if any of those teams can win the SEC East, you have to imagine they'll be right up there in the national picture as well. On the other side of the division, we'll jump back over to Auburn. Auburn and UCLA both had big days. UCLA, the most recent one, I believe, was Cordell Broaddus. There we go. Who happens to be Snoop Dogg's son, committed to UCLA, which a lot of USC fans not happy about that with how much Snoop Dogg has supported the Trojans. But Ryan, of those two classes, and those are both teams that kind of disappointed this past season. Now, they didn't have bad seasons, but they were expected to be right up there in playoff contention. Which of these two teams, those two teams, UCLA and Auburn, can benefit the most from these big classes and then possibly contend for a title in 2015 behind some impressive performances from freshmen?
Well, ultimately, I actually think that both teams can compete, but if I have to pick one that I think is more likely to do it, I'd pick UCLA. And I think the kind of common thread that your average college football fan would want to pull at here is the fact that Brett Hundley's not going to be back for the Bruins. However, they've got every other starter back on that offense, and they've got 18 starters back as a whole. And while I don't think it's fair necessarily to say that Brett Hundley was to blame for what was ultimately a disappointing season for UCLA, I think there's a few pretty smart people who cover college football as a whole and cover that college football team pretty closely that would say Hundley didn't live up to his billing this year, and he was a part of the problem at times for them. So getting a fresh face in there at quarterback doesn't actually sound like the worst thing. And now you start talking about adding in the 4 four-star offensive linemen they've gone out and secured and, you know, adding the talented running back that they were able to secure today. Jamabo, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with offensively, and I think that they're definitely going to contend for a Pac-12 South title and de facto contend for a Pac-12 title and de facto, once again, contend for a college football playoff bid.
Dustin, do you see the same thing happening where Jim Moore and UCLA can pretty seamlessly recover, I guess, from Brent Hundley leaving? Or are they going to take a step back just from a leadership standpoint under center? Do you think that is kind of a deal breaker for them?
I don't know that it's necessarily a deal breaker. I think it sets them back in the early stages of the season. And, you know, it's not too – I'm looking at their schedule now. It doesn't look like it's too anything too crazy. They've got Virginia at home, and then they're on the road at UNLV and come home to BYU. And I looked at this earlier. I think the big thing that stood out to me is they've got to go on the road and play a pretty good Stanford defense. And then the final two games of the season, they play at Utah and they play at USC. And according to 247 Sports, you know, USC had, I think they had the second best recruiting class and one of the top five from ESPN as well. So I think it's going to be really difficult for UCLA to surpass USC, especially with Cody Kessler coming back from the Trojans. It was an interesting question that we got because I don't know that either team, Auburn or UCLA, really has a good chance. I'd agree with Ryan and say that the UCLA probably has the better chance just because I think Auburn has too much to replace offensively. But I don't think UCLA takes necessarily back. I just think that their opponents and a little bit of a tough schedule as far as the road is concerned is going to stand in their way of a Pac-12 championship.
Yeah, I mean, as a Trojan, I would love for UCLA to sort of stumble out of the blocks again and maybe lose that one at the Coliseum, but that's just my take. One other storyline we had, I guess the one team besides UCLA and Auburn that really stood out today in terms of getting some late letters of intent and late commitments was Florida and Jim McElwain in his first season, or what will be his first season. Really had a lot of guys going to Florida. And then another new coach, Jim Harbaugh, just in the past couple weeks kind of pushed over the 10-person mark in their recruiting class for 2015. So it really seems like one is struggling in terms of new coaches, Harbaugh, and then McElwain really hitting the ground running. Is this going to be just a turnaround, Ryan, where McElwain – has his recruits from day one, and even this class was sort of his freshman class, and he can win immediately? I know there's question marks at quarterback that is. Do you think they can win immediately with the new head coach?
Given the amount of talent that is going to be naturally on any Florida school's roster because of the state in which, you know, they have to recruit from, I think there's always a chance in a league that's going to be as wide open as the SEC East that they can compete from day one. However, given what we saw out of them last year, I don't know that you'll necessarily see them make a particularly large jump in 2015 just because of this one recruiting class. I thought what they did towards the end of the day was certainly admirable. Martez Ivey is a heck of a player and a stalwart on an offensive line. Even being involved with Byron Cowart and Kerryon Johnson and Jeffrey Holland, who they ultimately lost to Auburn, were big time, you know, pulls for them or wins for them on the recruiting trail, you know, adding CC Jefferson. So they did some very, very nice things. And you're always going to have enough talent on a roster at Florida to compete. But I think they're probably one more full recruiting class from being able to compete in a way that we're used to seeing Florida compete like they had under Urban Meyer.
Yeah, and as we said, that SEC East is going to be tough next year. I mean, you have Georgia bringing a lot of guys back. Again, Tennessee was one of the youngest teams. They're going to be very talented this year. So even if this freshman class for Florida, you know, really performs well, it's going to be tough treading in that division, in that conference. On the other side, Dustin Harbaugh's a new coach too. It's not like Michigan and Florida really had all that different of seasons in terms of record. And yet McElwain's the guy coming from Colorado State. Harbaugh's the guy coming from the NFL. Why is the sentiment kind of that Harbaugh is just getting a pass for this first year, maybe even 2 years? People are saying, you know, wait 3 years and they'll be winning again. Why is it that Harbaugh is sort of getting this pass, you think?
Well, I'd say because Michigan fans at this point were desperate to get somebody in and fill that gap that Brady Hoke left pretty much after his first season in Ann Arbor. I think fans are willing, now that they have who they think will be the right guy, they're willing to be a little bit more lenient and give him a little bit more time to develop the talent and go out and recruit the guys. They saw what he did at Stanford. They saw how good he was in the NFL. So I think they know that they've got the right guy in the position. So they're going to be a little bit more tolerant, even if it takes a little bit more time. Now, like any fan base, when you start getting to year two, year three, and, you know, if he makes it to year four, which I'm sure he will, but if you don't see great improvement or dramatic improvement in your recruiting classes or on the field, that's when the fans are going to get a little bit more persistent and a little bit more persnickety about how the team needs to you know, start improving. So I think it's just because it's Jim Harbaugh. He's an alum. They have their guy in place. The quote-unquote Michigan man is in Ann Arbor on the sidelines. And, you know, McElwain is just another guy in Florida. He might be the guy. He might be the target that they wanted. But he's not replacing Urban Meyer. He's not replacing Steve Spurrier. He's just a guy that might be able to get Florida out of this hole. So I think that's probably why you see the difference there in how one's going to be perceived as compared to the other.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think we fail to remember the predecessor sometimes in terms of the expectation. So maybe there is a little more time for both of those guys. But they're heading into their first year. We also have Steve Sarkisian at USC heading into his second year, and USC finally for all the Trojans out there is back to full scholarships. And they have one of the top, as we've mentioned, recruiting classes in the nation. Rivals actually has them at number one. ESPN, I believe, is at three. Ryan, do you think that getting these scholarships back with this class, is it a pretty immediate thing that their depth just returns? They've always had the playmakers, but the Trojans the past few years haven't had that depth to really compete and for a national championship. Is it sort of a flip of the switch thing with getting these scholarships back, or does that take time as well to get back to that point where they're basically platooning the lines and they have a stable of running backs again?
Well, anytime that we're going to get an immediate influx of talent in the form of 26 really, really solid recruits like USC has right now, you're going to see the depth improve immediately. Now, however, looking at the scholarship numbers and the fact that you're signing classes of 15 or less throughout the course of the last couple of years since they've been on probation, and there's going to be a little bit of a gap before you can get back to a point where you've completely filled your allotted 85 scholarships and can completely fill out a full roster. So the limitations that the NCAA has, you know, they can be manipulated and worked around to where you can sign and backload classes. But where USC is right now as a roster means that it's probably more like two classes before they can completely fill a depth chart with the studs that they're used to having here. Now, the one really, really encouraging thing for USC fans right now has to be when Pete Carroll was there and they were competing on a year-to-year basis for national championships, you know, they kind of came up with this recruiting philosophy that dictated they would go out and get this core group of kids from the Southern California area that would make up, you know, 60 to 65% of their recruiting class and then go cherry pick throughout the course of the rest of the country. The fact that they were able to go into Georgia and get a guy like Adoga, a five-star offensive lineman, the fact that you're able to go into a place like Texas and get a five-star running back like Ronald Jones, and then fill out the rest of your class with 20 more really, really solid California kids, that's what's got to get USC fans really excited because it feels like exactly the way they recruited back when Pete Carroll was there.
All right, so when does Tomi Leather? I'm ready to go. We'll see this USC team now, fall 2015. Another team getting their full allotment of scholarships back, Dustin, is Penn State. You have James Franklin really doing a good job there. Do you think James Franklin can get Penn State back to the top of the Big Ten with where they are competing with the likes of Ohio State? I think it's tough to do at a place like Penn State because of, you know, where you are. It might be tough to recruit to Happy Valley. Is there, whether it's 2 or 5 years from now, a chance for Penn State to get back to the top, or is this the ceiling now for them, kind of the 9 or 10 win mark, even with these full recruiting classes coming in?
Well, I thought this year you saw that this was a team that defensively could compete for a national championship. Now, offensively, they had all kinds of trouble. I mean, you're talking about a team that ranked in the top 10 defensively and won 6 games in the regular season. So, you know, that's a big issue because if you can't score points, you're not going to beat a lot of teams. But one of the things I really like about this Penn State coaching staff and James Franklin is that he's filling needs that this Penn State team needs. The biggest issue was the offensive line, and Christian Hackenberg got sacked more than any other quarterback outside of your guy from Wake Forest, who I can't remember his name.
John Walford.
Yeah. So, you know, getting sacked 44 times, Penn State really didn't have wasn't effective in the running game, although Akeel Lynch looks like he could be a player who could really mix things up offensively for Penn State if he's able to get some run blocking. But they've got two of the top recruits on the offensive line coming in Sterling Jenkins and Paris Palmer. Then they've got some other really good talent coming in. They've got a good running back in Saquon Barkley and a wide receiver in Juwan Johnson. So they're going to provide a lot of talent at those positions. And he's going out and he's getting these guys some of the needs that he needs on his roster. So I think it's going to be a matter of time before Penn State's competing with the Ohio States, the Michigan States, the Michigans, and starts competing for national championships again. I really like what James Franklin has done. You did mention it's a tough place to recruit with everything that's gone on over the past 5 years and obviously replacing a legend in Joe Paterno and everything like that. So I think Penn State will definitely be back in the nation's elite here. I don't know how long that will take, but if James Franklin stays the course and continues to recruit as well as he has early in his tenure here, I think there's no doubt Penn State is going to have a lot to cheer about here in the next couple of years.
Well, that would definitely make the folks in Happy Valley pretty happy. And they have to be fairly optimistic heading into next season with the bowl performance that Christian Hackenberg had. I mean, he just threw for, I think it was over 350 yards. So hopefully good things happening there. We'll close it out today with our Hail Mary send-off. Ryan, I'll pose it to you first. If you were the number one football recruit in the nation and could go anywhere you wanted, where would you go and why?
I think this question needs a little bit of context. Is this 18-year-old me we're talking about here, or is this going to be 26-year-old me we're talking to here?
Let's go with current you. We've seen today that, you know, what 18-year-old you decided could change in the next 10 minutes or so. So let's go with your current Ryan Wooden.
Current me is just a much more pragmatic version of me. I have an accountant, taxes or something I think about all the time. My wallet jammed with receipts. So if I'm the number one recruit in the country, obviously I want to protect my own personal assets more so than anything and give myself the best possible chance to be an NFL prospect. And right now you do that at the University of Alabama. That is just, it's an absolute factory in terms of getting to the next level and in terms of, you know, being the most valuable commodity that I can be as the number one overall recruit in the country. I couldn't imagine going any other place but Bama.
Yeah, tough to argue with Nick Saban and the factory there. So, Dustin, what would it be for you? You also going to Alabama and they get the two prize recruits in Ryan Wooden and Dustin Schutte, or are you going somewhere else?
Well, they're not going to win many games if I'm on the roster. I'll tell you that right now. But you know, if it's me, after what I've seen this past season, and you know, I think I'm going to Ohio State for the sole purpose that you've seen the coaching staff from Ohio State be able to coach not only a backup quarterback but a third string quarterback to get them to a national championship. I mean, it's just things like that that are unheard of. Obviously, Ohio State has a lot of talent coming in on a yearly basis. And, you know, it's not like these guys are two- or three-star recruits regularly that are blossoming into NFL-caliber quarterbacks. They get really good players and really good prospects coming out of high school. But the way Urban Meyer is able to develop talent, the way he was able to do it at Florida, the way he's able to get the most out of his players, I mean, for goodness sakes, Cardale Jones had to have a press conference about whether or not he was declaring for the NFL draft, and we knew about him for 3 or 4 weeks. So, you know, I just think if I'm wanting to go to the NFL, if I'm wanting to win football games at the college level, I got to go to Urban Meyer, wherever he's coaching. And right now, that's Ohio State.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to argue with either of those programs. And you can always go, you know, the Richard Sherman route, try and get a Stanford degree, Ryan Fitzpatrick, try and get a Harvard degree, but these are football players that want to make a living in the NFL, so tough to argue with those. Thank you guys for being on the Today's You podcast today. You can find Ryan and Dustin on Twitter. Ryan is at Ryan_Wooden, and Dustin is at Sharp_Schutte. That's S-C CHUTTER. And you can also read all their stuff multiple times a week on todaysyou.com. Thanks, guys.
Have a good night.
Thanks, Colin.
You too.